D.L. Hughley, comedian and activist, begins his latest book, How Not to Get Shot and Other Advice from White People, with a list of unarmed black boys and men who have been shot by police officers. Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Philando Castile, to which we must now sadly add Antoine Rose Jr., who was laid to rest yesterday. This is no joking matter, but Hughley attacks this topic and much more, offering a tongue-in-cheek how-to guide for black people, covering such tropes as how to act, dress, speak, walk, and drive in the safest manner possible. The book is published by William Morrow, and I am pleased it brings him to our show. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, man. I appreciate it. Thank you.
So let's start at the very beginning. You dedicate the book to your son.
Yes.
Kyle. Mm-hmm. So what advice have you given him about what to do if a police officer confronts him?
Obviously, the same stuff you'll hear in the book, cooperate. I've also told my son, it's funny because people always they'll say, you need to teach your children respect, to respect the police. I think black parents in general teach our children to fear the police. You would think they're going outside to talk to a wild animal. Like, don't make any sudden movements. Don't make eye contact. Whatever you do, don't run. Dan, am I going on safari? No, son, you're going outside.
Right.
And so there are all those things. But you're more likely to be shot if you're black. And also, the people who are shot the most are emotionally or mentally handicapped. My son has Asperger's syndrome. Mm. So it's always been a big fear of mine.
Right.
And he's a fit dude. And so it's always been a fear of mine that someone wouldn't seem like I would, and you know, I don't know an America that has ever seen anyone of color be gunned down by the police that didn't automatically have a built-in excuse. Like, they've never been so appalled that they've been moved to action.
Right.
So, you know, they I think that more people get appalled at the result of a shooting than the actual shooting itself. Like, if there's Black Lives Matter and stuff like that came as a result of what happened. Black Panthers came as a result of what right. happened. But they get more mad at the result than they do, of what happens as a result of what the shooting than they do the shooting.
Yeah. The premise of the book is that white people have all kinds of advice for black men, black people in general, but black men, on how to avoid getting shot. How would you characterize how free white people feel in their advice?
Well, I think that obviously they have a different perspective than I would. And, you know, it's funny because you'll hear a lot of people say, well, there are more good apples than bad apples. But those bad apples are in our communities.
And they affect society at large.
Of course they do. Like, just what happened with Antoine Rose. That police officer was in January fired from a police department because he was brutal and a liar. He was sworn into a new police department. 90 minutes later, he shoots an unarmed black dude. But those are the people that are in the communities that we're in. Like, if you look at what happened with Gray here, that the policeman that was accused of, used a choke on him, mm-hmm. was brutal. The dude that beat up James Blake in front of the U.S. Open was brutal.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the people that we kind of come in contact with.
Mm-hmm. With rarely any repercussions
No.
for their actions, as we know. You grew up on 135th and Avalon in South
Sure.
Central Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
What was that like when you were younger? What would you describe?
Well, you know, it's funny because I didn't know that I was poor. I didn't know. I'm a kid. I grew up. And, you know, it's something that happened, I think, about a week ago where they had this little boy, 10-year-old boy in Chicago, and the police were looking for somebody that they said committed or escaped from. I'm not sure what they said he did, but they handcuffed him and he peed on himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember 8 years old growing up in Los Angeles. I was a kid that didn't have any perspective other than being eight. And I mean, we were walking along and this cop car pulls up and he says, come over here. And we started talking and he asked us where a guy in my neighborhood was, and we're eight and we don't know anything. They made us put our hands on the car, and the car ran hot. It was hot.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept saying, "Oh, this is hot. And he said, "You take your hands off this car again, I'm gonna blow your head off." I'm 8 years old. And I remember his breath smelled like something I'd never smelled before. And later on, years later, I would realize it was garlic.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with D.L. Hughley about his new book, How Not to Get Shot and Other Advice from White People. So most of the white people you encountered were police officers,
right.
You write, teachers, insurance men. I think this
right.
is important. Why were there so many insurance men in your neighborhood?
Because not everybody, all deaths are sad, but not on the unexpected.
Yeah.
Like, there are people, some people say it's for college, some people say for insurance. Like, if this dude keep messing up, I'm at least get a car out of this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you would have policemen, you'd have insurance men, you'd have teachers.
Yeah. I remember once I was attending a funeral in Detroit with a young black woman who had just lost her boyfriend who had been gunned down on a sidewalk. And she tried at the service to put a watch on her late boyfriend's wrist. And the funeral parlor director got mad at her and said, don't touch the body. Next time, don't do that. And just even the use of the word next time were such a huge signifier in terms of that environment she was growing up with and sort of that regularity. I think the insurance salesman spoke to that as well.
Right. It was, they were the only, and I remember after, it was funny, after my mother paid, years later, I'd been married and everything, and she gave me the value of the policy and it was $75.
Wow.
Because all they give you money for is to bury you.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. So it's not, you get a nice box and a send off and don't be too much of a burden on the family.
The white teachers, you remember, did not identify the fact that you had a learning disability, and so they kept advising you to apply yourself. Who was it that finally diagnosed you?
I forgot how it actually happened. But I remember being a kid, and they would say idiodidact or audiodidact, and I was like, what is that? What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what that meant. And years later, Kevin Klein, I had always heard teachers say that. And I was doing comedy, me and Joan Rivers and Robert Klein. And he said, you must be an audiodidact. And I said, that is what they always called me. And it was that you learn by hearing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that they said he doesn't, and they would always call me that. And I had no idea what it was. So I was in New York at Madison Square Garden performing with them. He says it backstage. And that's so no one ever officially said that anything was wrong with me.
Yeah.
They just put me in the back of the class. And then years later, through my son and through we're going through the process of diagnosing him. And the girl, lady at UCLA said, this, you you have the same kinds of things he does. But no one had ever told me that.
Yeah, so you went through your entire upbringing, adolescence and everything.
So I had no idea what it meant. Like, I knew that words would bunch up, they would seem to bunch up.
Right.
And so what I would try to do is read really fast before they started to bunch up.
Right.
Like, I tried to cope with it, but I just thought I was an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
So, but years later, I learned that, people have a different way of processing things and learning. And I wasn't, it's ironic because now I love the idea of writing books and I love reading and all that kind of stuff, which I never did before because it just always seemed like more of a challenge than it should have been.
Well, once you get comfortable in your own learning mechanisms, you're more confident, right? I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with D.L. Hughley about his new book, How Not to Get Shot, and Other Advice from White People, published by William Morrow. So the first advice you received from white people seems to be apply yourself, which implied you were somehow being lazy, right?
Right. And I don't think, I think that, studies bear this out. If somebody lives in a certain neighborhood or has a certain comes from a certain socioeconomic background, or is a parent of a single parent home, they're regarded a certain way. There's no doubt, even in the educational system, when black children are seen as more deviant, more destructive, more of discipline problems because of some things that might be inherent. Like 80-some% of people in prison, men in prison, have a learning disability, and so. There is a way that you try to protect yourself when you have some challenges that comes off as defiance to people.
Right.
And I think that if you consider 70-some% of our teachers in America are white women who don't necessarily have that connection with anything until they come to this school.
Right.
It has a different patina than it would to somebody else.
And they might have all the best intentions in the world, but they're unconscious bias. There's been studies done on this and how they perceive the young men in
the
classroom.
And it's not just black teachers, it's white teachers, it's black teachers too.
Yeah.
And so it's not these bias, and imagine your formative years. This is a story you start to tell yourself. Now, I would imagine there were any number of kids that were in my situation. My outlet happened to be comedy. Their outlet happened to be drug dealing or hustling or doing whatever it is that got them in trouble. And so our paths, they certainly morphed into different things, but they started out kind of pretty much the same way.
So you actually began thinking about this book you write when you went on the Megyn Kelly's Fox News show.
Sure. I remember when Megyn Kelly wasn't racist. Like, I mean, I remember now she's not racist on NBC, but she clearly was on Fox. And I remember it was after the Philando Castile shooting.
Yeah.
We were talking about police. She had me on to talk about, I think my other book was Black Man White House, and we were going to talk about that. And also the Philando Castile shooting had just taken place. and we were going to talk about policing and the reactions in the community. And she has on Mark Furman, who is the antithesis of a good police officer.
Mm-hmm. Los Angeles Police Department, you're probably well acquainted, having grown up in that area.
Right. Yeah. He was an infamous police officer. And I would venture to say that most police officers would say that's not the example that they would want portrayed of him.
Right.
But she sprung that on me, and we had this heated conversation, and she proceeded to tell me how Philando Castile could have did this and what could have done. And after that, I knew I would write this book.
Mm-hmm. And she also said that he could have been threatening to the police, right?
Sure, yeah. Sure. But he did everything he was supposed to
exactly.
do.
Exactly.
We watched him die on television. And it's one of the reasons I say what I say. And so I decided, now, people who are, there are more white men shot by the police than any other group, but they're
black men.
More white men are shot, but more unarmed black men.
Right.
like when they shoot white dudes, they got guns. They got guns.
Yeah.
But they don't get shot in you know, proportionally, of course we get, but a number, the number is larger for black. But you very rarely see unarmed white people get shot. And so I just decided hysterically to ask them what they're doing to be able to accomplish that.
Right. So there are three parts to the standard advice you get from white people about not getting shot, as you break it down. Comply with orders.
Sure.
Don't resist arrest.
Right.
Don't break the law and you won't get shot.
Right.
What don't white people get here about doling out those three steps?
I think that it's really because all you are is a sum total of your life's experiences. So if, in other words, you get stopped by the police officer, he's not disrespectful to you. You have a minor infraction. He's not abusive to you. That's your vantage point. But that doesn't mean that it can't happen to somebody else. I think the problem in policing, with policing in America, in terms of communities of color, is they're doing exactly what they've always done, which is keep us out of places we don't belong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at all this spate of people having the police called on them, it's because a lot of white people are going, "Why are you here?"
Right.
And so they've always, they're there to keep us where we don't belong. Like, what are you doing in this neighborhood?
Yeah.
Why are you in this store?
Yeah.
Are you buying? Why are you in this neighborhood? Why are you at this restaurant? And so I think that somebody said it best. I think Jason Mitchell, an actor, very talented actor, said, you should call the police for your security, not your insecurity.
Right. Yeah. So it seems like the main thing that we are in the middle of trying to communicate to white America is the fact that the experience of walking into any space and being suspicious until proven not suspicious.
Right. And right? That people justify it. Like, what happens is cop cams are good. It's good that we have video cam. But until we have bias proof juries, it won't make a difference. Like, for instance, if I or you committed a crime and it was on video, they would take that video and go, the prosecutor would go, "This is all you need." And the jury would go, "Yeah, it's right here. He did it right here." If a cop does something that you see him murder somebody, you see him do something that you know inherently doesn't look kosher, you'll go, "But we don't know what precipitated this." So one is given a presumption of guilt and one is given a presumption of innocence. And when there's a person of color involved, our natural biases go, "Well, I know how I would feel, and I've been afraid of people like that." And so their biases insulate their actions.
Mm-hmm. For some reason, white people are calling the police on black people who are just living their lives at an alarming high rate, something that's been going on forever, as you
sure.
say, but some more documentation sure. of it. There was Permit Patty who called the police about a young black girl selling bottles of
right.
water in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Philadelphia Starbucks incident, the Yale graduate
sure.
student, and firefighter in Oakland who was in uniform and participating in a safety check and had the police called on him.
Sure.
What's going on, but this has been going on forever, but what is it? I mean,
it's the idea. Listen, most people don't know the people that they're afraid of. They've seen them in the media. They've never had an interaction that would inform that decision. But because they have this notion of what something is, they're afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it really comes down to this. Generally, if look at some of the things that have happened, some of these innocuous encounters, whether it's a taillight out or whether somebody has an expired tag or if somebody has a warrant. These things are resulting in people's death because interactions with the police just seem to be heightened in that situation. I think there's fear and biases at play. Most people don't. I can tell you this. I don't know many black men who can't point to a negative experience they've had with the police.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I don't know a lot of white people that can point to a negative experience they've had with black men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
I've seen them on the news. I you know, even the way that we categorize, like, black on black crime as if it's a phenomenon.
Yeah.
90% of black people will kill black people, but 87% of white people kill white people. Asians kill Asians, Latin kill Latin, husband kill wives. That's about proximity. But for us, they give it a special designation that makes us that much more dangerous.
And I would submit anecdotally that many of the adverse encounters white people have had with cops have been of a totally different ilk in terms of traffic violations
right.
they didn't want to receive
right.
and so forth.
Right.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with D.L. Hughley about his new book, How Not to Get Shot, and Other Advice from White People. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with D.L. Hughley about his new book, How Not to Get Shot, and Other Advice from White People, published by William Morrow. You write about Nat Turner's rebellion. Remind right. us about what that was.
Well, Nat Turner led a slave rebellion. Tons of slaves took over and basically went on a rampage where they killed a bunch of white overlords. And I really do think it plants a seed. I think most people probably don't know about the incident, but that is a fear that black people are these marauding gangs of people. It's almost funny because we were talking off air. And we were talking about Tamir Rice, who was a 12-year-old boy in Cleveland playing with a toy gun. He gets shot by a police officer that was ill-trained. He was fired at an Independence Police Department, hired in Cleveland. 5 months later, he's killing somebody, an mm-hmm. unarmed kid. And what society did was first, the Cleveland playing dealer went and looked at Tamir Rice's father, who had a criminal record,
mm-hmm.
and then contorted itself. Because if an adult the same age as the cop who killed Tamir Rice had sex with Tamir Rice,
mm-hmm.
society would go, this child is not adult enough to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But that child is adult enough to be slain.
Right.
And in society, like a kid playing with a toy gun, which is what kids do.
Right.
It's his fault he got killed.
Yeah, and the flexibility of adulthood,
right.
as we're talking about, like, you know, with sentencing in some states, yeah, we've seen a lot of teenagers be subjected
sure.
to adult sentencing.
Sure, and yeah. it's like you watch what happened in Santa Fe. A kid walking around with a trench coat in 90-degree weather ain't suspicious, but two black dudes at Starbucks is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just don't.
I want to read a quote from the book that circles back to Nat Turner's rebellion that I think speaks to sort of the nature of the fear. You write, ask any old black Southerner, they all know the story of the slave uprising because it was incredible. Even when black people were slaves, white people were afraid. And that fear was about losing control of black people. Before black-on-black crime, before we asked to vote, before Black Lives Matter, we were being shot and hung by the police. Police are basically doing now what they've always done, which is to keep, inward, in their place. Whether it was removing us from a lunch counter or telling us to get back across the line or hanging us for made-up reasons, they have always been the agent of bringing black people to heel.
Right.
I mean, that really captured it. Even that line about controlling black people, that
sure.
seems to be at the heart of this.
Yeah, of course. And society, when they see them as their protectors. They see them as the guy, the old adage, you don't want to, you want to eat the steak, you don't want to see it get slaughtered. And I think society feels like that about a lot of people. And the difference is that now things are so much different because, you know, you know who you are. Like, now we see evidence. We have video evidence, anecdotal evidence, and people are still unwilling to accept. It's a simple premise for me. If a child can be held accountable, then why can't agents of authority be held accountable?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you make a mistake folding a shirt at the Gap wrong, you can get fired.
Right.
But yeah. if you are a police officer, what they tend to do is it's like what happened with Roseanne. ABC knew Roseanne was racist, wanted something. What they do is they get rid of her, but never change the system that made it okay for her. What they tend to do is fire the cop. They fire the cop, but they don't look at the system. Like, even the FBI in 2006, 2007 said that the police departments across the United States of America were permeated with white supremacists.
Right.
But their response is, what should the community do?
Right. And always that bad apple dialogue,
right.
stream of dialogue, right.
right?
Get the one bad guy out. It's not the system,
yeah.
it's the one bad guy.
But again, my point remains the same. The most brutal, the most, the people who are less inclined, who have the most infractions, generally police the neighborhoods that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't have an occasion to see the police officer.
Right. So how do you fit President Obama's presidency into this pattern of white people being afraid?
I think that every time a black person does something they've never done before. There's fear. I don't care if it's if it's breaking a baseball record. I don't care. Every time you see a black person do some, going to school for the first time, two things happen. They become afraid and they threaten to kill them. Right. They do. And there's really no excuse. When I do interviews, they'll say, we can't be a racist country. We elected Barack Obama. I bet the people that say that didn't.
Right.
Most white people didn't vote for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
It was the first time that something happened when they weren't in on it.
Yeah.
And there's a resentment to it. But I explain it by, I think Barack Obama was aspirational. He was who we wanted to be as a country. But I think Trump is reflective of who we are.
So you break white people's advice down into historical periods. Sure. I want to run through these. From 1619 to 1865, it's slavery. You say advice is a bit more mandatory.
Mandatory.
Just sort of leave it at that. Then from 1896 to 1965, Jim Crow. What was the advice from white people during Jim Crow?
It's really a derivative of slavery. Only we're going to be nicer about it. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
It really is.
And then, of course, 1970s, you label as, why can't you be more like Roots?
Right. Right.
1980s, why can't you be more like that nice boy Michael Jackson?
Right.
And 1990s, if Rodney King had just complied with police orders.
Right.
And then in the 2000s, white people discover another bunch of scary colored people, Muslims. The heat is off.
Right.
What was white people's advice, during the Obama era versus now the Trump? What was it during the Obama era? How was it colored?
I think, see, we've arrived. Look, it's post-racial. It was all of the things that go along with that. It was post-racism, if he can do it. You know, it's always funny. Society in general points at the exception and not the rule. They'll go, if he did it, how come you can't do it?
Yeah,
like if a rose goes through concrete, all of us should be the rose growing through concrete, as opposed to planting soil that's you know conducive for that growth.
Right.
But society in general points it, when it looks at somebody that isn't quite with you know one of us, they look at the rule and or the exception, and then say everybody should fit that exception, as opposed to looking at the rule, which is the aggregate. But I think that we've been more genteel about like. Everybody's worked up about Trump, but having a president who's racist is not new. It's retro, right? It's like there've been more.
Your Woodrow Wilson,
right?
Quotes.
I was gonna say. So I think it was where we thought or pretended that we were.
Mm-hmm.
There's a visceral reaction. Like right now, you had Jeff Sessions not a week ago use the very scripture to basically okay putting immigrant kids in cages. As people used to use to enslave black people,
mm-hmm.
So that's sobering to know that the very scriptures, and we're talking about we're supposed to be a genteel, evolved society, but the very biblical passages that they used to enslave black people, they're using to put migrant kids in cages, and it's weird because in California you can't even put a chicken in a cage. We have cage-free chickens, but it's so I think we all the seeds have always been there. We've just allowed ourselves to believe that they weren't.
Yeah, and you brought up this sort of idea of sameness. I think part of it is this white people's notion of assimilation.
Right.
And you have so many great photographs in the book about like how to dress and change your look and before and after pictures.
Right.
And it's just sort of our people wanting not to be able to recognize humanity in someone, but have that person look like me.
There's tribalism. I mean, like everybody's more comfortable around people who they have an affinity to or remind them of themselves. Nobody knocks you for that. But I think the one thing we wanted to do in the book, it's really, I think it was important for me to have a conversation because everybody's always, what do you contribute to the conversation? Well, this is my entree to the conversation.
Yeah.
And I think I tried to make it as satirical and sobering at the same time. But I think it's the thing I've done that I'm most proudest of.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with D.L. Hughley about his new book, How Not to Get Shot and Other Advice from White People, published by William Morrow. In chapter one, you write about the most common advice white people give on how not to get shot, comply with police orders.
Right.
But there is so much more to that, which you explain by examining what happened with Philando Castile when he was pulled over. Walk us through that exchange and how it makes it impossible not to follow this advice.
Well, Philando Castile did. He was a black man who had been stopped over 50 times. He had a lot of interactions with the police. He had, purchased a gun, gone through the legal channels, took the training, and his parents had always been afraid that having a gun. I know, side note, black police officers are afraid to carry their guns off duty because they're afraid they're not going to be explained that they're a cop fast enough. Right. But Philando Castile did everything. And when the policeman pulled him over, he immediately told him he had a gun.
Right.
Which you thought would disarm you.
Right.
Especially if we're going to have all these states like Minnesota and Texas where you have the right to carry open carry. You know, mm-hmm. So now we have a double problem. So, and he was still shot, and he was shot on air. And what they did, shot on basically we were horrified. Even the Minnesota governor came out and said he thinks that this was definitely racism. What they did was appointed a jury full of pro-cop white dudes, and he got off.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the NRA never said one thing, even though he was a card-carrying member of the NRA.
Mm-hmm.
And so I I think that all of the, he did exactly what he was supposed to do and still died.
And goes, and of course we've all seen the horrifying video, and he goes very deliberately to retrieve his wallet.
Right.
So you also have white people explaining that you need to comply with police orders fast.
Right.
Right.
But not too fast.
But not too fast, because that would not have helped Tamir Rice or John Crawford.
Right.
Why? Because?
Because I think when there is that level of bias and fear, that everything you do or don't, like if you move too fast, what are you hiding? If you move too slow, you're being defiant. Mm-hmm. So there is no right note to take.
Right.
And again, it was one of the, it was the first thing I've ever done on paper where I was angry and laughed at the same kinds of things. Like in the book, we have illustrations of how to dress and how to move into a neighborhood and how to cook and how to name your children. And
right.
But it's all based on things that we've actually heard people say.
You quote many alarming statistics, but one that really stood out was that 50% of the people who are shot by police have some kind of disability, and you mentioned
sure.
this earlier,
mm-hmm.
so they might not understand how to comply with police orders. Two examples are Laquan McDonald,
sure.
who was shot by police even though he was surrounded by police who were in no danger, and he suffered from PTSD and other mental disorders. And then there was Keith Scott. What did he suffer from?
Keith's brain.
It was
brain.
Yeah.
It was a traumatic brain injury.
So, you know, in those cases, can we say why they shot them? I mean...
Because they could.
Mm-hmm. They could.
Listen, I can't get in somebody. I know that if I were allowed to do something and there was no penalty to pay, why would I stop doing it?
Mm-hmm.
There's no incentive for a policeman to treat us differently other than being embarrassed on Twitter or maybe losing your job. But what is, you know, it's so rare for anybody to be convicted, and even when they are, the sentences are minimal. And so I don't think there's an incentive for a policeman and at least interaction with people, communities of color, they have to change.
Yeah. You write that when being questioned by a police officer, you wrote, quote, a carefully placed sir can work wonders
yes,
for
yes.
a white officer's attitude.
Yes.
For a white person, there's something about being called sir that whisks them away to a more genteel time. I don't know. There's just something about it that makes them feel nostalgic. It puts white people at ease, like sipping an iced tea on a porch in summertime.
Yes, it you know,
goes back to the idea of respect, that misguided
really does,
idea.
I'm going to tell you, I was 19 years old, and my wife, she was my wife then, we were going to... I lived in LA and she lived in a city called Carson, and we were going to Manhattan Beach, right? So there were certain routes you had to take, because no matter what, if you went down Torrance Boulevard, and people in Los Angeles know this, you were black, you got pulled over. So I'm with this pretty girl that I would later on, my wife of 32 years, I decide to take the shortcut, and sure enough, we get pulled over.
Uh-huh.
And my wife, she has a whole different experience to me. She's like, I put my hands up instantly, and I knew what the light was on, and she's like, why are you stopping us? I'm like, girl. And he said, she doesn't know. And I said, no, she doesn't. He said, your house broken, huh? I said, yes, sir, I am.
Wow.
And he said, all right, and he gave his, I gave my license. And she's like, what does house broken mean? He knew that I knew what he needed to
right.
let me go.
Yeah.
I knew the language. So that worked its way into the book. It was just like, they knew that you got it.
You gave him his Southern California sir.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. But you got to remember, Los Angeles, very brutal. They're the most deadly police department.
Yeah.
They routinely hired people from the South, men from the South, to deal with us.
Yeah.
And so that was my experience.
And that's another factor, too, of how all of these police officers that have trouble in one department are able to go to other departments.
Absolutely.
And get
absolutely.
Work,
absolutely. You know?
One trope Fox News and Breitbart likes to discuss is the black-on-black crime rates. You write in your book, people like to point to a report that says 90% of black people who are murdered by other black people. But the same report also says that 83% of white people who are murdered by white people.
Right.
So it turns out that most people are murdered by people they know and maybe of the same race, yes?
Hey, when they shot up the country concert
in Vegas.
They wouldn't call that white-on-white crime, even though a white dude shot a bunch of white people. Mm-hmm. If a black dude got shot in that crime, he was a janitor working. You shot him in the keys. But but they don't. They tend to cauterize. There was a shootout in Texas where a motorcycle gang, 9 people got shot. When Aurora, Illinois, when he walks in there, Aurora, Colorado, he shoots all. They don't quite. What they intimate is that there's an inherent malice in us that makes us more dangerous than society when we're actually not.
Mm-hmm.
The reason, like, they would have you believe because black people live in these neighborhoods is dangerous, is because poor people live in this neighborhood is dangerous. Find me a safe poor neighborhood.
Right. Yeah.
One, anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You won't.
No.
But they, what they try to do, and I think black on black crime is a more dangerous phrase than the N-word.
And particularly when you pair it with the other stat, because it just reveals that we are editing out half of the story.
Absolutely.
To develop a new narrative or maintain a false narrative.
Right. And it's the one that allows society to see children being slaughtered and to say nothing about it. It's the one that they're protecting us from the boogeyman. Because you can't just have a boogeyman. You got to have an embodiment of it. And these statistics add to that.
In your chapter on you have to understand cops are scared. Why are they more scared of black people than white? We know the historic context, but in 2018, is it really being encased in that history?
I think that if you look at it, they don't know us.
They don't know. Dehumanization.
They don't know us. They don't live in our neighborhoods. Like, even if you look at Rodney King, they worked in Los Angeles, but they lived in Simi Valley. So it was little more than an occupying army. But you couldn't do to Afghani citizen what they're allowed to do to us.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't do what routinely happens with us. And I think it's that, like, what they don't know about us, they fill their heads with.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a brand new guy, you're on the police department, you've never been around black people, we put you in the worst of the worst. That reinforces a narrative. Then you tend to see everybody the same way.
Right.
They're different than me. So right. You go in, you deal with that, and you go back to utopia.
Right.
So there's no connection. There's no, and I think it's simple. I think that if you, to serve a community, you have to be familiar with it.
You have to know those people. They have to be human beings.
When I grew up, if we had a good dude in the neighborhood, a good cop, he knew the people and we knew him. And somebody had done some dirt, let me have him. I'm going to let him kiss his mama and say goodbye, get in the car. No, problem solved.
Right.
And the men in our neighborhood, he would talk to the men in our neighborhood, and they say, you know, you know you did wrong. I'll walk you out to the police car. Ain't nobody going to jam you up. But there were certain things that happened. If you ran from the police, you got your ass whipped. That was just going to happen. If you got smart with them, you got your ass whipped. That's what's going to happen. And I think that you got to look at a society that grew up, that was trained, those officers trained them that way. So it's the way things are. And now they see this image of this is what I don't understand. When they always say all cops aren't bad, the one sobering thing they never take into account is that all people they shoot aren't either. Like if you make mistakes, and if you make mistakes, you should be held accountable for them. It doesn't mean, like, if you mess up on a plane, you might be a good dude, but you ain't flying no more.
Right.
You forfeited that right.
Right.
And I think if you want to wear a uniform that bad, you ain't got to be work for UPS. But if you can't. If there's no level of accountability, and not just a one-sided one, how will we ever evolve? How will we ever stop seeing these things happen? Unless this could only happen unless it has society at large's tacit approval.
I have to say, reading this book was quite a dualistic experience for me. On the one hand, it was sort of surreal and demoralizing that such a book needs to exist. But I was buoyed by the humor you bring to the page, and I think through that great humanity. So thank you very much.
Thank you,
and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, man. What a good time. I had a great time.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with D.L. Hughley about his new book, How Not to Get Shot and Other Advice from White People. Tonight at 7, D.L. Hughley will be signing copies of the book at Bookmark Shop in Brooklyn. That's at 8415 3rd Avenue.